listening to Regional Originals, a Masters of the Stage podcast. Regional Originals is a series of interviews with some of the most exciting directors and choreographers working in America's regional theater today.
Hi, I'm M. Graham Smith, and this is Masters of the Stage, Regional Originals, brought to you by the SDC Foundation. Our guest today is Elizabeth Williamson. Elizabeth has worked on Broadway, off Broadway, in London's West End, and around the country. She's currently in her seventh season at Hartford Stage, where she serves as Associate Artistic Director and Director of New Play Development. She has also served as Associate Artistic Director and Literary Manager for Pioneer Theatre Company, where she founded the company's New Plays Initiative. Elizabeth has developed new work with Bill Kane, Sheila Callahan, Robert Friedman, and Stephen Lutvak, Kyle Jarrow, Kimberly, Matthew Lopez, Wendy McLeod, Janine Neighbors, Dan O'Brien, Dominique Sarand and Stephen Epp, Bess Wall, Lauren Yee, and Mary Zimmerman. World premieres she's dramaturged include The Inheritance at London's Young Vic and in the West End, which was nominated for 8 Olivier Awards. Anastasia, which recently closed on Broadway, A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, which won the Tony Award for Best Musical, and many more. Recent directing credits include Henry V, the world premiere of Seder and Cloud Nine, all at Hartford Stage, and translations including La Dispute and The Life and Death of Pier Paolo Pasolini. Thank you so much for joining us today and hanging out and asking and answering some questions about new plays.
Oh, it's a joy to be here, and I can talk about new plays all day long.
We're in San Francisco at the moment. We're new play geeks, so we're about to head off to the New Strands Festival at ACT later today. But you're based in Hartford, Connecticut at the moment, at the Hartford Stage?
I am. As you said, I'm finishing up my seventh season at Hartford Stage, but I'm a Bay Area native. My family is all in Berkeley, so it's good to be home. It's also great to get to go to one of the readings at the New Strands Festival at ACT this afternoon. I'm really excited to hear Luis Alfaro's play.
Oh, me too. So the first question that I ask everybody who's on this program is, where did the theater find you and how did the theater find you?
You know, I've been making theater in one way or another as far back as I can remember. I think it started with my stuffed animals. I remember doing a really provocative political farce behind my parents' sofa about the Watergate scandal with my teddy bears when I was like 7.
Oh my God.
By the time I was 10, I had roped all of my friends into being in a production of Joan of Arc, which I wrote and directed and made my best friend play Joan because she was clearly better casting for it than I was. I think I still thought at that point I wanted to be an actor, but all the signs clearly pointed to other side of the table. Poor Beth never wanted to be on stage, but she's a serious political activist. And I think even at that young age, I was like, you are such a Joan of Arc. You have to play Joan.
Oh, my God.
So, painted backdrops, rigged up curtains between the dining room and the living room.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I totally corralled everyone into doing it. I was already doing cross-gender casting, by the way.
And was it like...
It was an all-female company.
Amazing. Was it like a Shaw or other like
it was
written
me.
Text? Or it
was
you?
Me. I wrote a 10-page play that covered all the major events in Joan's life.
Amazing. And was there like a piece of art or a piece of theater that changed your life or that you experienced that kind of turned something on in you?
Oh my God, I mean so many over the years, right? I think I remember when I was very young going to hear Rosencavalier at Santa Fe Opera, and my dad was like, there aren't subtitles, I was 12, so we can leave at intermission, and I just loved it so much that I was like, no way, I'm staying up, it's probably the latest I'd ever stayed up. When I was in high school, I was in Chicago, and I saw a small production of Zeus Story that I remember just blowing my mind at the incredible Chicago act. You know, I don't know who the actors were,
right,
but it was just that sort of phenomenal acting in a tiny space downstairs at a cafe. Ariane Mnouchkine, the first piece I saw of Théâtre Soleil, really really changed my thinking. And also I felt like it was something I'd been sort of looking for years. That was when I was in my early 20s. A really beautiful, epic piece that was political without being about being political.
Okay.
It was the first sort of great piece I saw about migration and refugees around the world.
That's wonderful. So tell us a little bit about your programs and your new play development philosophy at Hartford Stage. What are the values that guide the work there, and how does that happen in practice?
Totally. I think what's incredibly important to me is starting with what each artist's idea for their piece is. So I don't have a new play development model that I apply to plays. It's much more a, what are you making? What do you need in order to make it? I feel like when I came back to America after studying at Lecoq about 15 years ago, I was really surprised because it felt like new play development, most places I was going was staged readings, was readings often at music stands of plays that weren't really exploring the physical dynamics of the piece, what was unusual, unexpected, formally different about the piece, not really giving the artist the room to do that. So from the time I founded the New Plays Initiative at Pioneer on, it was really important to me to say, we're going to do the development model that is needed for each piece, and I'm going to start by asking, where are you, what do you need? So at Hartford Stage the last few years, we've actually got a really small new play development budget. And when I got there, there was this great reading festival called Brand New, but it ate up the whole budget.
Okay.
And it meant that the five pieces we did as part of that festival all had to have public readings because it was also an audience development tool.
Okay.
And after the second one of those, I was like, okay, if this is all the money we have, we need to be spending it on getting the work that we've commissioned, that we're developing, that we're most excited about, to the point where it can go on stage.
Yeah.
Because the goal of new play development is getting the show on stage.
Yeah.
And I would say the pieces I'm proudest of since then have all really benefited from that model. The first commission I made at Hartford Stage was Matthew Lopez's The Inheritance.
Yeah.
And that's a piece that I've been working on for almost 7 years, and it never had a reading with an audience.
Okay.
So the very first development for that, Matthew hadn't even started writing it, and he said, you know what I want is a private forum of three generations of gay men talking about their lives, what it was to come out at each point they did, what the major political events in their lives have been, what the fights had been, and also just having an intergenerational conversation, because one of the things the play is about is what it is to have an identity that you don't inherit, and how you find your ancestors, your mentors, the generation ahead of you, and especially how hard that is for Gen X men.
Yes.
Who lost so much of the generation ahead of them. So we did, that was the first thing, and then we did a series of, first a cold reading of the part one when it was incredibly long, and then a series of workshops once Stephen Daldry was on board directing, where Stephen was really pushing at how are we going to stage this piece, because it's very different in form from anything Matthew had written before. And those workshops from early on informed what the staging would become. But I worry that sometimes with a week-long workshop, if you know you've got people coming in at the end, you get into this teleological mode.
Oh, totally.
Where everything is towards the performance.
Yes.
Long before the piece is actually ready to be performed. So I think that was really valuable for Inheritance. Then Kaneza Shawl, we commissioned her piece, Jack And, which is this phenomenal, thrilling downtown piece. Kaneza came up with ERS and Worcester Group, and she's an extraordinarily brilliant director and creator. And for Jack And, she wanted time. She wanted to be able to bring up whatever collaborators she wanted. We brought in a ballroom dance instructor. Jackie Sibley's Drury came up for a day. It was this phenomenal week-long work session where she was just working practically. And she didn't want to show anything to anyone. And she figured out the basic tools of making the piece. No way she could have done that if she'd had to have an audience.
Right.
And that was it. That was one of those pieces that already at that point, she knew it was going to be part of BAM's Next Wave Festival. But she didn't have the resources to make it. So we were able to spend all of our new play development money for her on getting the piece where it needed to be, along with Baryshnikov Art Center. A lot of other supporters came in on that show. And then Bess Wohl's Hartford Stage Commission, Make Believe, is probably the scariest, to me as a producer, piece I've ever commissioned and developed. Why is that? Play where Bess basically said, okay, when we were first talking about her commission, she was like, you're not going to want to do this one. But, and I was like, oh, what? You know, obviously. And she said, I want to write a play that's an adult play performed by kids. And it's four kids. At that point, it looked like it might be four kids on stage the entire play.
Mm-hmm.
It's now only 45 to 50 minutes. I say only.
Yes.
But it's a play where we watch these kids in their playroom in a suburban East Coast town in the late 80s, early 90s. And as they play and talk and do their homework, we gradually realize their parents are divorcing off stage. It's kind of ugly. Nobody's really looking after these children. And Bess in the play, which is also very funny and charming, is really looking at what happened, how can four kids age 6 to 11 go through effectively the same experience and respond to it so differently and grow up as such different people? And what would it be like was sort of her originating question, to go back and just look at that as it happens and to look at it through the kids playing on stage. And that is the play that probably came closest to giving me a heart attack as a producer, because we're going to do this. Yes. Oh my God. And Bess was really focused on, she didn't want like career professional kids who were good actors. She wanted it to feel really natural. So we did a series of workshops with the director, Jackson Gay.
Yeah.
Just basically going, okay, how does this work? And Bess had written like 5-page scenes, and the first workshop was like, oh, that's too long. You can't have the kids do a 5-page scene. So it became shorter scenes.
Uh-huh.
And then how does the play influence the writing? The kids playing.
Yeah.
So we developed that over several years, and I don't think we ever brought in an audience for that. That's not to say if the playwright wants an audience.
Right.
I'm not totally happy. Like Sarah Ganscher was much further on in writing Seder, and workshop we did at Hartford Stage. Like 4 days into the workshop, she said, actually, I would love to hear this with an audience. So we wrote all of the people we knew would be interested and got some people in for her. But really, it's focusing on what do the writers need or what do the directors need, whoever's originating the work.
Yeah.
And how do we support that and how do we get it on stage? And I think that's especially important for things that are really experimenting with form, because our staged reading series is best suited to the kind of 20th century well-made play.
Yes.
And is less well-suited to some other kinds of theater.
So would you say, overall, the trend you're observing from the conversations you're having with playwrights is that public-facing reading with music stands is less useful?
I think it can be very useful at the right point in the process. What was important to me at Hartford Stage in particular, because we have limited resources, is I think a lot of other theaters have the resources to both be doing all the development and have a reading series, and we kind of were able to be like, either we'll do the reading series or we've got enough money to do 3 serious workshops a year.
Yeah.
And we'll open them to the public when it's helpful, but that won't be the audience development for new plays won't be the main goal behind the reading.
Sure.
The development of the work will be the main goal. And I know, like, watching what Ars Nova has been producing over the last few years, they are really process-driven in their workshops, and that's led to extraordinary pieces like my friend Sarah Ganscher and the Bengtsons musical, 100 Days, and I'm going to say this wrong, Lucky Ones.
Lucky Ones
is the one that Ars Nova developed.
That's right.
And Bess Wohl's play Small Mouth Sounds that Rachel Chavkin did that gorgeous production of, and they developed it slowly. And in workshops, similar challenge, like, how do you do a play that the rule of the play is it has to be silent?
Nobody talks,
You can't do a staged reading of that.
Right. Does that also feel to you like what you consider to be a play or a playwright is evolving?
I think that American theater is getting more and more interested with plays that are challenging what was sort of standard American form. There was a real idea of the form of the American play that certainly when I came back from Lecoq and having been training in Paris and looking at a lot of European theater, I had different ideas. And I think a lot of the most exciting plays and playwrights that have been having big successes in the last couple of years, what's starting to feel to me like a real renaissance in American playwriting is stories we haven't heard on stage told in ways we haven't seen them done before on stage. And I think that's to me why it's so important that institutions that are developing new plays follow the writers rather than pre-setting how the writers are going to work.
Yes.
And say, okay, if you're making this extraordinary piece, what resources do you need? How does that work?
Yes. That feels like, I did not attend the Lecoq School, but I did graduate from the Dell'Arte School of Devised Physical Ensemble Theater Making.
Oh, we should talk about that.
Which we should talk about. But it does sound like your work at the, because my teacher at Dell'Arte, Ronlyn Foreman, is a Lecoq grad and came very much from this pedagogy of the kind of wide open space of devised process. And it sounds to me like you have, like, very much embody that spirit of kind of controlled chaos of devising work that doesn't fit any existing form.
Just exciting to look at different forms and to, I mean, the assumption when you're training at Lecoq is that there's a whole life before you get to the point where you have to speak. And making sure that when you're doing a show on stage, you've got all of that life happening as well. And everything that we're, you know, we're doing a podcast, but I'm sitting here, you know, making hand gestures, leaning forward, et cetera. Everything that we're communicating physically is so important on stage as well. And I think I went to that work partially because I come from a really intellectual background.
Okay.
My parents and grandparents were all English professors. My parents are poets. And it seemed really important once I got into the field that I make sure I was really engaging physically with the work as well.
Yes.
And I went and did a week-long training at Complicité devising a new piece and totally fell in love with the way Annabelle Arden works.
Uh-huh.
And then I was like, oh, I need to go to Lecoq and learn. Not that I am now a great physical theater director like Annabelle Arden, but it certainly influenced how I work on everything.
It sounds like it's also influenced your dramaturgy and
absolutely.
I feel like you are one of the, I feel so lucky for all our listeners because you're one of the first people who I feel like can really help us understand what this mysterious word that our field throws around a lot, like all of the different things that it can mean. So I don't know if you want to take a crack at just like trying to put a definition out there of what does a dramaturg do?
Sure. I mean, I think there are as many answers to that as there are productions, probably, because what a dramaturg does on any production can be very different from another production. I mean, the dramaturgy of the piece is the how we're telling the story of the piece, what every choice we're making about how we tell that story, how we structure that story, what the structure of both the play and the production is. I think a lot of dramaturgy often involves doing a ton of research and a lot of, you know, pulling together research for the entire creative team and actors who are doing the show. I personally don't do that very much. I mean, I love doing research, but I'm also producing a season of shows at Hartford Stage and directing and adapting. And I think what I'm strongest at as a producer, as a director, as a dramaturg tends to be structure.
Uh-huh.
And how pieces are structured and audience experience and knowing at what point you're relaying what to the audience and how you're building that relationship over the course of a piece. So I think partially because of the Lecoq training, but also just because of 15 years of practical experience and over a decade's regional theater producing, I'm very tactical and practical. And I very much dramaturg the production, not just the play. So I can be a very useful dramaturg when I'm in the room. But like on Inheritance last fall for the West End Transfer, I was dramaturging Besswell's play Make Believe and directing my own production of Henry V at the same time. And they all overlapped by a week,
which
was like the craziest week of my professional life.
Yeah.
It was insane. But it meant that once I left London, looking at Matthew's new writing outside of the context of Stephen's production, it was not very helpful anymore because I didn't know what the whole production was doing.
Yeah. That's so interesting.
So it's important to me as a dramaturg to be dramaturging the production. I'm not, like, if I were an editor, I would be of a book. I would just be editing the book for publication.
Yeah.
But dramaturging a piece for production is what is everything doing? And often a lighting cue can be doing something that means you don't need that in the text.
Right.
So you have to be looking at all of that and aware of how the director is approaching everything and what the actors are doing. And also be a little, it's helpful, I think one of the ways a dramaturg can be very helpful is to be deep in what a piece is trying to do and also be able to step back a little bit so that you're able to go, this will read that way, this will read that way, this will read that way, that will add up to all this, maybe this is the missing piece, how do we solve that missing piece? And it's not then saying, oh, you should write this or oh, you should direct this, but oh, I think this is the piece we don't have, how could we go at doing that?
Yeah. And I imagine that there are as many different ways of practicing that relationship with different artists as there are different ways of doing that job.
I think there totally are. I mean, I think one thing that one hears again and again is from people, from good dramaturgs, is that they ask a lot of questions. Mm-hmm. And that often the most important thing is to ask the right question at the right time.
Yeah. Yes.
And at the right time is also key. Yes. So I'll often have a thought and then say, oh, that's an interesting thought. Let me see if that still holds true in a week.
Yeah.
And then later see where... Well, it's like directing. You don't want to give preview notes to the actors.
That's right.
In the first week of rehearsal.
No.
So that same sort of, okay, where are we in the process? At what point do I ask what?
Yeah. When will that take care of itself? And when will be the point where I need to bring it up? So that,
yeah.
Because it's not taking care of itself.
Yeah. Which is actually... as we were talking about it, exactly like directing to a degree. The last thing, you know, an actor is going to kill you if you start giving them preview notes too soon. And some of those notes, as you say, they'll just disappear.
Yeah.
Because it'll be solved by the actors as they work.
You were just saying about this wonderful, crazy moment where you were kind of on board with Bess Wall's play and Matthew's play in London, and you were directing Henry V kind of like all at the same time. And that just made me want to ask, is the way that you think about classic mm-hmm. plays like Henry V really different than the way that you think about brand new plays as a director, as a dramaturg?
That's a really good question. I don't think so. I think that in a way I'm always thinking, what is this play in this moment? I think every production that I do, whether I'm programming, producing, directing, dramaturging, why is this an exciting event? Why are we doing this right now? Why is this essential and valuable? To do right now. The Royal Court had that old motto, right? I'm going to pull out a chestnut that has probably been said many times on this podcast. Do new plays as if they were classics, and do classics as if they were new plays.
Yeah.
So question everything in a classic. Why are we doing this? What does this moment mean? We have such received ideas of what, especially what Shakespeare is. We think we know those relationships.
Yes.
And just coming to them fresh as if this is new. Let's put aside all that history. How does it work?
Yes.
How do I make it work on stage? You have to do, because if you don't do that, you have the moment that you're just doing the received idea and it's not actually happening for the audience in that second. So I try, in a way, I try not to. Obviously, the great thing about doing new plays is the playwright's there with you, and if they want to change something, they can.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're doing it in the active, in the moment conversation. Though with Shakespeare these days, one is also cutting a lot.
So right.
You're going, can I make that work? Cut.
Right.
This joke, is there any way this joke is still funny? Not really. This one, however, hilarious.
So tell me about your room. Like when you're making these decisions that we've just been talking about in terms of what to cut, what to keep, how to keep it relevant. What does your room feel like?
You know, unsurprisingly, I'm really, really collaborative, and I believe in the best idea wins always in the rehearsal hall. So I think especially in Henry with the comedy, it was important to me to get some really, really brilliant actors and see what they make funny and trim to a degree around them.
Okay.
So you go in having cut what you know.
Yeah.
And sort of figured out how you think it works and what you think the muscles are, and then working with the actors on structuring those scenes.
And do you, like, I don't know, like, my bias about someone who's brilliant at dramaturgy would be that maybe you would spend more time at the table than not, but you also have a physical theater background, so are you up very fast?
I am up pretty fast, because you can talk, you can say you can make anything work, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Me of too much table work is
that we can make
a really good argument for this will work because da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, let's see.
you don't know until you do it.
Yeah.
If it's real.
Yeah. I mean, one of our jobs is to have a really good guess what's going to work and what isn't. And I think having worked on producing over 70 shows over the last few years, I do tend to have a pretty good guess what the audience will get. But it's really important to me to see people doing it, especially working with actors, what we're saying we're doing versus how does it actually work?
Yeah.
And let's figure that out.
Yeah.
And that's important with new plays, too. You can talk about what a scene's going to do.
Yes.
But you need to actually, okay, once the director's directing the actors, what is this scene doing? Is that the piece we thought it would be?
Right. Or my, not. Yeah, my
Stephen Daldry will often go, okay, let me just do an experiment and show you something. So you're having a conversation structurally with the playwright. He'll be like, just, this isn't obviously what you would write, but let me just show you.
Okay.
And do an experiment, and that experiment may then provoke new writings.
Okay.
Provoke the actors. I don't mean provoke in a bad way. I mean it in a propose,
to create a new dialogue. Yeah.
And I really love working in a very, very practical way.
What would one of these experiments be? Like, would it be like improvise a text, or would it be put an action in a different place in an existing text?
Well, we were just working on the Fire Island sequence in Inheritance last week, and a lot of it is where does the party go?
Mm-hmm.
And what's the quiet sequence of this play?
Mm-hmm.
And what's in the middle of the party? What's coming out of the party? How does that impact the dynamic in the scene? So is this scene a first thing in the morning scene? What if it happened as if it were a during the party scene? Stuff like that.
That's awesome. What do you look for in actors when you are auditioning, when you're casting? What kind of actors are the actors that give you the most to work with as a director?
I really love actors who are creators and actors who are deeply invested in the work they're doing themselves, come in with a really strong idea of who this character is, how they're going at it. That's again probably coming out of the Lecoq background.
Yeah.
I love working with actors who have that deep ownership from early on and are coming and working and fighting for what they think it is, and holding to a position and pushing it and trying to prove it and see how it works.
Yeah. Does that feel at odds with some of the way that particularly like casting out of New York City often works? Or do you feel like you can just see in the auditions that you hold, like that actor has a strong point of view and is a creative force?
I think you can see it. I mean, I also have a very collaborative audition room.
Oh, great.
So that I'm really trying, I'll often say, I'm just trying to figure this out with this character. What if it's like this with someone? And often, like Tony Lopez, who just did a show at ACT, who's wonderful, came in for Henry V. And I think we figured out some stuff about the Dauphin together in the audition room that then really influenced the production. But I also have worked all over the country and have actors I love from all over the country.
Yeah.
So a lot of my casting will be offers and will be offers to actors from all over the place. I spent time in Minneapolis and Chicago here. For that Henry V, I was lucky enough to get Karen Aldridge, who is one of the great Chicago actors.
Yeah.
Peter Francis James, who's right down the road teaching at Yale, was the chorus for Henry V. Felicity Jones, who was part of Theatre de la Jeune Lune for years, did three roles, Archbishop of Canterbury, Nym, and the French serving maid, Alice. And she was just brilliant. And she was one of the first people I knew I wanted in it. And she was like, you're calling me up to offer me these three roles. I was like, yeah. I need you.
Yeah. That's so cool to have a team of actors who you have great history with, who you kind of have a shared set of experiences to draw upon. What about designers? Does the same hold true for designers? Do you have
there's so many wonderful designers. I feel like that, one has the opportunity to work with so many amazing people. I work with Nick Vaughn a lot as a set designer, who I just think is incredibly brilliant and thinks in a similar way to me. I've known Nick for years. He's a visual artist as well as a designer, and he's very, very smart, and he thinks from the beginning about what's the audience dynamic we're creating with each production. So how does this relate to an audience? How does it relate in the space to the audience? What rules are you setting up? That kind of stuff.
And do you like to give your designers or maybe it's, I'm sure it is different from production to production, but like, do you often find yourself presenting the designer with like, along with the script, I really need, you know, these five elements to be part of how you consider doing this? Or do you really like to let the designer kind of run and do research before you start becoming prescriptive in what you're...
I try not to be prescriptive.
Okay.
Definitely. I mean, I think, you know, I am the same person. I am the same person I am, whether I'm directing or dramaturging or producing. So a lot of the things will go across. This will sound like something I was saying earlier, but I'll start with a lot of questions.
Yeah.
Here are the things I'm trying to figure out with this production. This is what I think is true about how this world works. Here are some artists I've been thinking about a lot with regard to this piece. Here's how I think the actor's relationship to the audience will work. But I'll start with questions, not with, I think this is what the set looks like or what the costumes look like.
Yeah. And that feeds them. Your questions feed them.
Yeah. I mean, I'll have long conversations about what's this, what's that, how does this work. Right now I'm working on Jane Eyre and I'm thinking a lot about interior and exterior space and how interior space in Jane Eyre is both safe. On the Yorkshire Moors, you're safe. Mm-hmm. From the very beginning, there's this idea of the outdoors as being dangerous, but also incredibly liberating.
Mm-hmm.
And especially what that means to a woman in England in the 19th century and the home being the woman's domain and what it is to get out of that.
Yes.
And how essential it is to get out of that, to be able to breathe, but to be able to breathe, to be able to live, to be able to be a full human being. And how at the same time, there's this deep idea that if you get out, you may die.
Oh.
And she almost does die.
Right.
So it's the metaphor is incredibly powerful. So that to me is the big challenge with finding what the set design is for this piece.
Yes.
Is how to create that. And then as you track through the story, the house that she's almost okay in but not quite is burned to the ground when she comes back and is finally at a point where she can get together with Rochester and they can have a relationship. He's moved to a house that is half outdoors and half indoors. It's uh-huh. decaying into nature. So it's really fascinating to go through. And when she, on her own, is okay and independent and providing her for herself for the first time, she's in this tiny little room that is also both outdoors and indoors. That you open the door and it feels like you're on the moors and she has just enough fire to keep warm.
Mm.
So those are the kind of
yeah.
questions that I'll be digging at and going, how does this work? How do I make the audience experience that?
I can't wait to see how you and your designer solve those questions.
You do. We'll
see. Is it worth saying that at Hartford Stage, you also have a very unique space in which to design, that the theater is super thrusty. It really kind of spills out toward the audience, and the audience is almost on three sides.
It's totally on three sides. It's a really great three-quarter thrust. It's the best space for doing classical theater. That's where the work lives best at Hartford Stage. We did do a renovation of Hartford Stage right before I got to the company so that you can now also produce in the proscenium.
Uh-huh.
And that's how we've been able to do musicals like A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder and Anastasia, which we built a lot of to go straight to Broadway.
Okay.
So we're able to have that set up and to do a show, rehearse a show, produce it in such a way that it could transfer into another proscenium house. For Henry V, where I was really looking at, in a very democratic way, at what happens to the entire country when this young king decides to go to war, and what happens to all of us as a company, and how are we as a company approaching this from right now in America, I actually converted the space into the round. So part of the design process was building a set of seats upstage on what would be our stage set in proscenium to create, and Nick did this fabulous job of just making it feel like it is as if the theater's built to be theater in the round.
Yes. That's so fascinating. I would love to ask you about how your audience like met that new space.
Oh, there was a lot of, oh, how cool, we didn't know we could do that. Can we keep this? Can we do it again?
Oh, nice.
It was really fun. But for that, there was also a little bit of where's the set? Because I was taking the chorus at its word, and I really, I'm just going to go back to actors for a second and say this was able to work because I had Peter Francis James playing the chorus.
Yeah.
And he's so extraordinary that that first chorus saying, you know, we're all you get, guys. Just this company. We don't have princes. We don't have horses. All you got is us. And we started in rehearsal clothes in the round with the whole company coming out slightly staggered, slightly ahead of Peter. So by the time he came down and the show started, everybody's just there in their rehearsal clothes, maybe holding a piece or two going, okay, here we are.
Yeah.
This is it. But the audience did have a little bit of, where's the set?
Yeah. So our program is all about the regions and speaking to directors who are working, you know, sometimes in New York, but mostly out in the regions. And I, you know, this makes me want to ask you what characterizes your audience at Hartford Stage or in New England more generally? Like, what are they curious about? What is their limit? Like, what are the kind of things that they have a really developed taste for?
I think we've got a really wonderfully rich audience. Connecticut is a very populated, though getting slightly less populated, state. We've got a lot of wonderful theaters. You've got Yale Rep, Long Wharf, Hartford Stage, Goodspeed, the O'Neill Center, all within spitting distance of each other. In Connecticut. So it's a really, for a regional area, it's a really rich regional area. I think theaters around the country are at the moment having a conversation of who is our community? Are we reaching all of our community? How can we build relationships that we haven't been building? Hartford, we have the challenge that we're in a very poor, financially unstable state capital. In the middle of a much richer suburban area. So it's a very complex, fascinating place to be producing theater. We've recently started a series of major new community engagement programs that are aimed at breaking down barriers to access and building relationships in parts of the city of Hartford that we haven't had great relationships with in the past. We're partnering with the Hartford Public Library and with a lot of local nonprofits to create curated series and bring in neighborhood ambassadors. You can check out tickets to Hartford Stage at any branch of the local public library up to 30 days in advance. So I think it's, and with Melia Bensusan coming in, I think we're going to be doing even more of that work, and the theater is asking itself and its community in pretty rich ways, what is Hartford Stage? What is the community of Hartford Stage? Who are we programming for and with?
Yeah.
So it's an exciting couple of years to be in Hartford.
And your theater is in this transition, of course, with Amelia coming in.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. And a new managing director coming in soon.
Oh my God, so much change.
Yeah.
We're almost out of time. I can't believe this has flown by. But we do have time for like one more question. And I'll give you a choice. These are two questions that I love asking, and you can choose which one you want to answer. But one is about a total catastrophe that you have weathered and learned something amazing from. Or, so that's one.
Do I have to have learned something amazing, or can it
no,
have just
you,
been
you
a
could actually just tell a really good story about a total catastrophe, and that will be wonderful enough. Or if you want to make a magic wish for the American theater, if you could rub a magic lamp and have like one wish of a way that we make theater that could be different, like maybe a foundation is listening and you could be like, wish, here's my wish that we develop theater in this way rather than this way. So those are your menu of choices.
I want to do both, but obviously I have to say, how are we going to make theater better? Because I think that our resources are so limited right now in regional theater. We have a 3 to 4 week rehearsal process. And just to go back to new play development, since that's the big conversation today,
yeah,
I think it's very hard to do really challenging new works in that length of process. And that's why workshopping is so essential to me, and having workshops that you can really do the work in. And I think some foundations are doing a great job of supporting that and helping get more workshop time in and more rehearsal time in. But I think that that's the biggest thing to me, is that one of the challenges is to go, how are we doing each piece in a really exciting new way? What's the event of each experience, and how are we not? There's a danger that you'll just fall back on how has this show been done before?
Yeah.
Because that's an understood thing that can be recreated to some degree. And with that amount of rehearsal time, it can be tricky sometimes for people not to do that. And yeah, it's essential to me that every production, everything I produce, feel like it's a unique event. It's an essential event. There's the time to build it up. There's the time, there's the community time, there's the development time, there's the design time.
Yes.
I mean, there's a degree to which we have to design in a certain way in American theater right now because we have to start building at a certain point.
Yeah.
And there's a point in rehearsal where you can't make more
discoveries
because you've already locked in. If you're in opera, that's a year ahead.
That's a year out before the actors are even in the room.
It's not as bad in theater. But I think that's the big thing. And with really big shows that are then picked up and done around the country, it's especially hard.
Yeah. And it's...
And the funding model of regional theaters has just changed radically over the last couple of decades. There is not the philanthropy that there was.
No.
And theaters are having to refigure out how they work, reinvent the model.
Yeah.
Which is potentially exciting, but is coming. One of the things that's changing how we run regional theaters right now is a shifting financial model and financial challenges.
I mean, just one of the things that you mentioned, I feel like I see it starting to happen all over the place, where rehearsal periods are diminishing. That there are some companies that are like experimenting with like, well, what if it's 14 days and it's a full production and the audience, you know, as long as we do our work and we come in with the whole show pre-blocked and kind of almost like the way that opera works, the audience won't know the difference and we're going to save like 2 weeks of equity salary. This is a great idea. And for me as a director, like when I hear that, I say, well, there's no time to actually make an artistic discovery.
Yeah.
There's no time to make a mistake and to kind of move forward with a different direction.
You're stuck with your first draft.
Yeah.
And some people's first drafts, I work with directors whose first drafts are brilliant and who can absolutely come in having done all of that, but it will be that kind of show. And excuse me, you won't have time to do the full discovery process with the cast and really go, oh, that can be that moment. Let's recreate it to build up to that.
This has been such a terrific conversation. Before we say goodbye, I wonder if there are things that you have that you're directing or dramaturging that are coming up in July and August that you could let our listeners know about, so in case they're in the area, they can come check it out.
That's great. I don't have anything in July and August specifically, but I am hard at work with Matthew Lopez on The Inheritance, which I'm dramaturging, which will be in New York this fall, and I am adapting and directing Jane Eyre for Hartford Stage this winter.
Yes, wonderful. And there is something coming up that you're dramaturging that might be closed by the time this airs, called Flamingo Kid.
Yeah, we're doing a new musical by Robert Friedman and Scott Frankel of The Flamingo Kid at Hartford Stage, directed by Darko Trejnik, which we're deep in previews for now, which is going to be fabulous.
So so maybe there will be a future life for that our listeners can look out for. Thank you so much for sitting down today and having this chat.
It was awesome. Such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
This podcast was brought to you by SDCF, Stage Directors and Choreographers Foundation. SDCF acknowledges and extends a very special thanks to its 2018-2019 leading contributors, the David Lee Foundation, the Hargrove Pierce Foundation, the Oki Foundation, Trip Coleman, Sheldon Epps, Linda Hartzell, Doug Hughes, and Thomas Kale for their support this season. SDCF events and programs are designed to offer access, opportunity, and community to directors and choreographers at all levels of career. To find out more, visit our website at www.sdcfoundation.org.